Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, we'll talk to a French doctor in charge of a medical team heading into the earthquake-ravaged Iranian city of Bam. And two Iraqi Americans we spoke to earlier this year during the war in Iraq on how they see the war's aftermath.
If Iraq were to be an Islamic country or with nationalistic trends and good relationship with Iran and with Syria and pro-Palestinians, this probably would be a democracy in Iraq. This would be the majority of the Iraqis. Is this truly what the West want to see in Iraq?
Also, why do shy gay men seem more vulnerable to AIDS? And reviewing a year of war, terror, and Americans' continuing obsession with Paris Hilton. These stories and our review of Cold Mountain coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The U.S. has quarantined two calves from the Washington cow with mad cow disease. Dr. Ronald DeHaven, the Agriculture Department's chief veterinarian, spoke to reporters this morning.
That action, I should emphasize, is being taken out of an abundance of caution, not because we perceive that there is any risk to the safety of the food at this point.
DeHaven said the Agriculture Department is widening its investigation to find the birth herd of the mother cow, which has been slaughtered. He said that could take days or weeks. Meat produced the day the mother cow was slaughtered has been recalled, but DeHaven said he sees no danger to consumers at this point. Israeli soldiers opened fire on peace activists in the West Bank today, wounding an Israeli man and a foreign woman. The demonstrators were protesting the Israeli barrier being constructed in the West Bank. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
An Israeli military source said the demonstrators were using wire cutters in an attempt to cut through the barrier in the Palestinian village of Masha in the central West Bank. The army said the gunfire from soldiers was in accordance with regulations. Demonstrators on the scene said both live ammunition and rubber bullets were fired by the soldiers. The demonstrators said the soldiers were never threatened during the protest. Left-wing Israeli members of parliament called for an investigation into the shooting. One lawmaker demanded to know who gave the order to open fire. The army announced it would set up a panel to look into the shooting. Israel has drawn widespread international criticism for its barrier project winding through the West Bank. The Bush administration and others have said the barrier could damage peace efforts. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In Turkey, Istanbul's governor says proof has been uncovered confirming al-Qaeda was behind last month's series of deadly suicide bombings in the city. In those attacks, over 60 people were killed and hundreds more were injured. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Istanbul Governor Muammer Gürler says that members of an al-Qaeda cell carried out November's suicide truck bombings. Gürler says the cell has no links to any Turkish group and had been set up by al-Qaeda members recruited outside of Turkey. The Istanbul governor says the evidence comes from the interrogation of scores of suspects arrested since the bombings. According to analysts, the announcement will be a relief to the government, which is facing mounting pressure to crack down on Turkish Islamic groups. All those involved in the attacks were Turkish citizens. In the last week, Turkish police have made a number of breakthroughs in their investigation. Istanbul police have raided numerous houses in the city, recovering nearly a half a ton in explosives. Authorities say the raids have prevented further attacks. For NPR News, I'm Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
A half-day session on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up now 25 points at 10,330 in light trading of 220 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 6.25 at 1975. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have moved generally higher in today's half-day session. McDonald's gained some ground after sinking earlier in the week on news of the first mad cow disease case in the U.S. The stock market will close at 1 p.m. Eastern today and open for a full day on Monday. Most European markets are closed until Monday. In Japan, stock prices closed higher today. The Nikkei average of 225 selected issues was up just over 52 points from yesterday, closing at 10,417.41. Japanese investors bought shares in steel companies after China did away with retaliatory tariffs on steel products. Good news at last for FAO Incorporated. The bankrupt toy retailer has been granted permission to sell 34 of its The Right Start stores. From member station WHYY, Brad Linder reports.
The King of Prussia, Pennsylvania-based FAO has been granted permission by a bankruptcy court
to sell 34 The Right Start stores to Hancock Park Associates, an investment firm based in Los Angeles. The Right Start locations specialize in books, toys, furniture, and accessories for babies and toddlers. FEO filed for bankruptcy at the beginning of December, saying the company didn't have enough cash to get through the holiday season. Earlier this week, a bankruptcy judge had rejected an offer for The Right Start, declaring that Hancock Park Associates didn't have the financial backing necessary to keep the stores afloat. Details of the latest offer haven't been released yet. FAO is continuing with plans to shut down its 89 Zany Brainy toy stores while it seeks out buyers for its FAO Schwartz locations. For NPR News, I'm Brad Linder in Philadelphia.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders, books, music, movies, and the imagination behind them. At Borders, it's the original thought that counts. Location information at BordersStores.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's here and now. For the third time in a week, a major earthquake. As many as 4,000 people are feared dead in Bam, an historic southern Iranian city of 80,000. Here's Associated Press reporter Ali Akbar Durrani reporting from the site of the quake in Iran.
A helicopter survey of the devastated historical city of Bam shows that over 60% of the houses have been devastated to the ground.
The quake registered 6.7 on the Richter scale and follows quakes in Southern California and Costa Rica this week. Joining us is Dr. Emmanuel Baron, the medical director of the Paris Office of Doctors Without Borders. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Doctor, 60% of Bam's homes have been destroyed, it's believed. Power and phone lines are down. There's no water. Where do medical teams start in such a situation?
Well, when we arrive in a city like Bam today, what we try to do is to assess very briefly and quickly the situation in order to be able to call for more assistance within our organization. We start where we can. We start where we arrive by assessing briefly the situation. Then we try to find an angle how to do with relief and medical assistance.
And I suppose you're completely dependent on the equipment you bring with you, because much of the medical hospital infrastructure in BAM itself will have been destroyed or severely damaged.
Yes, you're right. During this assessment, we try to also assess the level of destruction of the health structures and then decide what we bring. But it's right that we are not only bringing human resources, but also materials and medical items and relief items mainly, of course.
Dr. Baron, what are some of the unique medical problems that you will find in an earthquake situation?
This is a situation where people are being pressed, and in this case, you must help them with some intensive care and surgical assistance. I'm mainly talking about this crash syndrome, which is a syndrome that you mainly find earthquakes, well, in destructions of buildings where the bodies, the people, are being compressed by concrete, stones, walls, roofs that fell down on them. You can have direct trauma on organs such as liver, spleen, thorax. And you can also have indirect consequences on heart and kidney, indirect consequences of compression of the muscle. This is the definition of the crash syndrome, when the compression leads you to a necrosis of your muscles and then a release of in the bloodstream of toxins and potassium. And here comes the danger for the patient. But you must not only think of this syndrome, because you also will probably need to do some surgical procedures for people with contusion, and it's another part of the activity. Then the third medical part, if I may say so, is related to consultation, general consultation in the following days of the earthquakes. And more than the medical aspect, our intervention also contains all the relief items that must be brought with us regarding shelters.
And always a tremendous concern about the spread of disease where there's not enough water or there's water that's been contaminated. Tell us about that.
Absolutely, you're right. And this is why we send also some non-medical items with logisticians, because we know that if you don't provide sufficient water and shelter to the population, then you may expose the population to secondary consequences of the earthquakes, which is the coming of outbreak.
Doctor, finally, how long do you have to bring people out alive who may be still alive, trapped in homes that have collapsed?
Yeah, we sometimes find people after some days still alive, but for most of the people, and particularly children and older people, then after three days, it becomes more difficult to find people again alive.
Dr. Emmanuel Baron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Emmanuel Baron is the medical director of the Paris Office of Doctors Without Borders. As the first bombs fell on Baghdad last March, Here and Now spoke to a number of Iraqi Americans who, as they watched the skyline of Baghdad illuminated by U.S. bombs, both worried about loved ones they'd left behind and hoped for their relatives' liberation. 9 months later, we've invited back two of the Iraqi Americans we spoke to then to see what they're thinking and feeling now. Bon Sinawi joins us from Oakton, Virginia. Welcome, Bon.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And Laith Hadi is in our studio. Welcome, Laith.
Hi. Thank you.
Bon, when we interviewed you last spring, you had no doubts at all that overthrowing Saddam would be a good thing. In fact, as the bombs began to fall, this is what you said.
That moment of joy, I just refused for anybody to spoil it for me. I just wanted to enjoy it so much. And this choking noose around our necks is down, this symbol of fear, that feeling that Saddam is invincible and nobody can ever, ever get rid of him, has been somewhere in our psyche. And it's just so great to be relieved and see that, you know what, God is great and he is not.
Bon Sinawi, last March, as bombs began to fall on Baghdad. Bon, what are your emotions now, hearing those words, about all that's happened since in Iraq?
Well, it's far more complex. I do want to say that seeing Saddam captured again was another great moment for me. It was poetic for me to see him in that hole, humiliated and captured. It was just as if all the humiliation that the Iraqis had to suffer on his hands. These are two moments that define how I feel about this whole thing, because I have built ambivalent feelings about the rest of it. I feel that I am in the middle. I don't belong to those who support the war or those who are against it. This, and I know quite a few are like me. We see the damage that the war had inflicted. We see the whole complexity of the situation. It's not very clear to those who look at it and say, oh, the war is great, or the war was wrong.
But, Bon, without the war, Saddam Hussein would never have been in that hole.
Is that true, though? Is that really true?
What do you think?
I think that the same powers that wanted him to stay for so long and supported him and kept him there and contained him in what was beneficial for their best interest could have followed different policies that would have not kept him in that hole. Saddam Hussein remained in power not just by his own virtue. He stayed there by support by the United States, by the West, by France, by Germany, supplying him with the chemical weapons. He was built to be the monster he is by the West.
Laith, you're a software application developer now. You've been here in the United States since you were 20. Mm-hmm. Your reaction to what Bon has to say.
I have no doubt in my mind that that war was justified. Regardless of whether the U.S. or Europe, France, whoever support him in the past, that happened in the past. It was a mistake. Continuing with that mistake would have been a major, even a greater mistake. Going in there and getting Saddam and definitely catching him alive and exposing him, the type of person he is the greatest thing that anybody, any Iraqi could think of.
Bon, your family, relatives, have suffered in the course of the occupation, right?
I actually have a cousin, an 18-year-old, who was shot. He was at the kitchen table with his mom when a stray bullet hit him in the head. So you wonder, if was it necessary for the civilians to have these cluster bombs all over the place? Was it necessary for bullets to kill civilians? Could Saddam have been taken out a different way? I think the war was, the way it was constructed and the way it was executed was more of a theatrical thing to serve different political aims, far beyond basically getting rid of Saddam and saving the Iraqi people.
Laith, your response.
I need to mention that I did lose a cousin myself. I think every Iraqi in here must have some relative, close or far, that had died because of either Saddam or because of the war, and we all are suffering because of that. But again, all of this suffering is caused by not just one person. It's not just Saddam. It's the whole regime.
Bon, what would you say to the mother or father or brother or sister of an American soldier who'd lost his or her life in Iraq?
I would say my heart feels for you. It's like me losing my cousin. It's the same. For me, it's a loss on both sides. I don't see it as them and us. I'm, as you see, I'm a combination of two cultures.
Sure.
It's not them versus us, to me, unfortunately. And that makes it harder for me to take sides or to see it in black and white.
Do you feel gratitude to that family that lost someone?
I definitely know that these soldiers were doing their duties, and they paid the price for following the orders that they were given. So I pray for them and for their families.
Laith, I'd like to ask you the same question. What would you say to the relative of a coalition soldier who lost his or her life in Iraq?
Well, my heart goes out for them. I thank them deeply, you know, from the bottom of my heart, for the sacrifice that they gave in order to free the Iraqi people. These people came as liberators. It's true what they're talking about, you know, being occupation force, but hey, this is a war. The reason why the U.S. and the American soldiers are there are to keep the peace. If they leave right now, you can bet there will be massacres committed by different groups.
Do you believe that Iraq will be transformed, become more democratic, and perhaps inspire the entire Middle East with that as a result of the sacrifice of these young soldiers?
I certainly hope that that would happen. Iraq is definitely a fertile ground for this type of government. I mean, we have different, you know, groups, different minorities, and having a democratic government is really the only way, for a government to work and operate in Iraq.
Bon, just to finish up, is democracy likely in Iraq? These casualties among Iraqis, among coalition soldiers, are they part of a sacrifice that will lead to a transformed Iraq? Do you believe that?
Well, I guess it depends on what your definition of democracy is. Is the democracy an absolute democracy? Is truly what the United States wants to happen in Iraq? If Iraq were to be an Islamic country or totally Arabized or with nationalistic trends and good relationship with Iran and with Syria and pro-Palestinians, this probably would be a democracy in Iraq. This would be the majority of the Iraqis. Is this truly what the West want to see in Iraq? That's a very big question that people need to look inside and think before they say, well, democracy. I hope for democracy in Iraq, but at the same time, I'm afraid that this is not what the United States wants to see in Iraq.
We've been talking to two Americans, Iraqi Americans. It's been an extraordinary year for both. Bon Sanawi, thank you very much for joining us from Oakton, Virginia.
You're welcome.
And Laith Hadi has been here in the studio with us in Boston. Laith, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, a new study on the vulnerability of shy people to disease focuses on gay men and AIDS. And later in the show, war, terror, and Kobe, Lacey, Paris, and Arnold. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Back when bloodletting was the first thing a doctor would do for just about anything that ailed you, doctors also made much of something called melancholy, which was a kind of sad disposition that was believed to make you sick. But now there's a new study that seems to establish, scientifically, a more definite link than ever before between temperament and illness. For one thing, it seems particularly shy or introverted gay men seem more vulnerable to AIDS. Joining us on the line from UCLA is Professor Steve Cole, the lead author of the new study. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Professor, what did you conclude?
Well, in this study, what we did is tried to identify the biological mechanisms responsible for this phenomena. We'd known for many years from a variety of different infectious disease studies that shy, sensitive, introverted people were more vulnerable to a whole slew of infectious diseases, ranging from colds and flus all the way up to accelerated HIV disease progression. What we didn't understand very well was why this was the case. We didn't know much about the biology of this phenomena. And one of the opportunities we had in this study was to really pin that biology down well, because we understand so much about the cellular and molecular mechanisms involved in HIV disease. So in this study, what we found is that a specific stress-responsive component of the nervous system, known as the sympathetic nervous system, seems to be more active in shy, sensitive, introverted people, and the chemicals released by this set of nerves when people are under stress seems to accelerate replication of the HIV virus, at least in tissue culture studies. And what we found is that in this particular study, that in real live human beings, not just in tissue culture, those who are shy and sensitive and have this elevated sympathetic nervous system activity also seem to show higher basal rates of HIV replication, quicker loss of CD4 T cells, and poorer response to antiretroviral medications when we put them on them.
But, Professor, how scientifically can you determine whether somebody's introverted or extroverted?
It turns out there are actually quite good instruments for this. This whole dimension of personality has been under study for many years, and there's a variety of different instruments that all measure what appear to be the same basic component.
But do these people answer a questionnaire, or do you follow them around for a couple of years? I mean, how do you know?
Well, in our case, we had them answer a questionnaire, but the way the questionnaires are built is by having people observe having trained raters observe the behavior of individuals after they've filled out the questionnaires, and picking out from these questionnaires only the particular statements that actually seem to correlate with this objective observer recorded behavior.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, this would seem to be very disturbing news for anyone who has a more diffident personality, because you're not suggesting, or are you, that a person who then tries to become more outgoing might get less sick? Can you change yourself? Can you change your personality?
Well, you can to some extent, but it's a hard thing to do, and it doesn't happen very often. The best example of this sort of thing is that when people begin taking selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac or Paxil, especially their friends and family members often notice that they become quite a bit less sensitive and shy, and you know, the flip side of that is they sometimes notice they also become more indifferent to them, and that the you know, closeness intensity of their relationship sometimes is altered. So there are certainly biochemical interventions at the brain level that actually do seem to be able to modulate these kinds of things. It's also possible to help people change their psychological response to situations so that they don't have quite such powerful stress responses in certain situations. But it's been very difficult to systematically revise a person's whole personality and create a, you know, from what was once a diffident introvert into now a raging party animal extrovert.
I would imagine. Well, Professor, your study seemed to focus to a degree on AIDS, but is this across the board, all diseases, from colds to cancer?
Well, we don't know that for sure because we haven't done these sorts of analyses in those other contexts. But what I can say is that this heightened vulnerability certainly seems to be true, at least in the context of infectious diseases. There were some very nice studies done that show that introverts are more vulnerable to getting colds and flus. The way they did those studies is they took a bunch of people, put them in a hotel room so that there were no differences in their social behavior, where they went about their daily business and that sort of thing, try to control their exposure, basically, to colds and flus. And then they sprayed a controlled dose of a rhinovirus up the noses of these individuals, and they looked to see who got sick under these circumstances. And it turns out that introverts were, I think, something on the order of 2 to 3 times as likely to contract a full-blown cold under these conditions as were their more hardy, robust extroverts. For cancer, we don't know very well. There's been a lot of speculation over the years about a cancer-prone personality. And the phenotype, you know, the image generated in these studies of the cancer-prone personality looks a lot like this sensitive, introverted phenotype that we're talking about here. But it's been much harder to do the epidemiology to show the heightened risk because few people per year actually come down with cancer. So you would need to do a very large study in order to actually be able to identify this effect.
But you are certainly suggesting, just briefly to finish up, that treating mental disorders, particularly the kind that might make people retiring, is a way to perhaps prevent them from getting sick.
That's potentially the case. But on the other hand, I would be careful not to think of these shy, sensitive people as having a mental disorder. Certainly when it begins to interfere with their lives in a drastic way, they may, you know, come to feel they want to change things. But a certain degree of shyness is part of the normal spectrum of human personality. And that appears to be, you know, part of a more fundamental, basic difference between the way different individuals are put together that apparently has been valuable over our evolutionary history. So what we prefer to do is think of these individuals as exceptionally vulnerable and think about ways to protect them from the unique vulnerabilities that they experience.
Interesting stuff. Thanks very much, Professor.
Sure.
Professor Stephen Cole joined us on the line from UCLA. Next time on Here and Now, a year after it first emerged, we take a look at the global economic and medical toll SARS has taken. And our Washington Roundtable mixes politics with religion. That's next time. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our editorial roundtable on a year of war and terror threats and Americans' continuing obsession with the high life and low life of celebrities. And a review of the latest best-selling book made into a movie, Cold Mountain, starring Nicole Kidman and Renee Zellweger.
Number one, you got a horse? I can plow all day. I'm a worker. Number two, ain't no man better than me, because there ain't no man around who ain't old or full of mischief.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Thousands of people are dead after a devastating earthquake in southern Iran this morning. The 6.7 magnitude quake struck around 5:30 when most people were asleep. The latest estimates put the death toll at 4,000, but officials say as many as 10,000 people might have been killed. Ali Akbar Darini reports that much of this ancient city of Bam is destroyed.
He said a helicopter survey of the devastated historical city of Bam shows that over 60% of the houses have been devastated to the ground.
Hardly any buildings in Iran are built to withstand earthquakes. The country sits on major fault lines. Three U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq in one of the bloodiest days for the military since Saddam Hussein was captured. One died in a rebel ambush. Two others were killed in bomb explosions. The death toll in that plane crash on the coast of Benin has risen to 111. Most of those killed were Lebanese citizens heading home for the Christmas holiday. Miraculously, 20 people survived the crash. Still not clear exactly how many people were on board the ill-fated jet. Two people are confirmed dead in a mudslide in Southern California. Rescue crews and helicopters continue to search for several others who are missing. Authorities say a group of 24 people were celebrating the holidays at a camp just north of San Bernardino when a structure holding 10 people was swept away by the mudslide. The mudslide started after a storm dumped more than 3 inches of rain on a landscape heavily scarred by recent wildfires. Mudslides in other parts of Southern California have shut down some rail routes through the area. U.S. officials have quarantined two calves from the Washington cow with bad cow disease, even though transmission from mother to calf is considered unlikely. Agriculture officials are more intent on finding the herd the cow was raised with, as the cow was probably sickened several years ago. The disease has an incubation period of 4 to 5 years. It's spread by eating food that includes parts from an infected cow. Shoppers are flocking to the malls and stores today looking for after-Christmas bargains. Retailers hope business is brisk to help them meet their year-end goals. On Wall Street, the shortened sessions have stocks up at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 23 points at 10,328. The NASDAQ is up 5 points at 1974. And the S&P 500 is up 3 points at 1097. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. How are you feeling as this year ends? You know, about the state of the nation and the world and all those other profundities. There is good news out there. For example, the U.S. swiftly won a war in Iraq, and now as vicious a dictator as ever lived is in custody, humiliated, his terror apparatus no longer threatening 23 million Iraqis. But as U.S. soldiers continue to die in Iraq, new terror warnings are up. and the country's seemingly infinite fascination with high living celebrity and low life scandal still trumps any deep thoughts about the state of the nation and dark thoughts about war and terror with many Americans. Joining us on the line are members of this week's editorial roundtable. Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Bill.
And Mark Jerkowitz is media columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. Well, Guy, let's start with you. 2 years ago this week, Richard Reed, remember him, the shoe bomber, questioned by French authorities at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, then allowed to board a flight to Boston in which he tried to detonate a bomb. Now, this holiday week, a number of flights canceled from France headed for Los Angeles because of alleged terror threats. Does this just go on forever? I mean, Guy, you're not an expert on terror, but what's the mood in Western New Hampshire about the war on terror?
I think we've all become experts on terror here over the last couple of years. It would be nice at the end of the year if everything really did end and we could start over, but this is sort of an artificial end that we're coming to. I was looking at the French press this morning, and they say in Paris that their concern was not really over terrorism, but was not to worsen relations with the United States, which is why they canceled those flights. And they also say, Le Figaro, the conservative newspaper, says that the United States said if they didn't cancel the flights, we would deny airspace to the French airlines. So,
you know, Mark, you're always left with a vague sense that it's just all too murky, aren't you? As Guy points out, U.S. officials putting very serious warnings out there, and the French say, well, as far as we can tell, there's nothing to worry about.
Well, you know, you contrast it with sort of the finite things that you said in the intro, Bill, about Saddam Hussein is captured now, his regime is over. Policymakers like to say that was terror with an address. We are fighting terror without an address. We will never know, my guess is, whether anybody dangerous got on those flights or was planning on getting on those flights in France or not. And it not only poses a difficult threat for policymakers, but it poses a difficult threat for people in the media about how to cover these kinds of warnings, how seriously to take them. I think one of the most interesting things you notice in the coverage of this is the way the New York Times seems to studiously downplay news of these kind of warnings and alerts, despite what the rest of the news media in this country does.
Mm-hmm. You know, speaking of coverage of the war specifically, Mark, in Iraq, Journalists Embedded. Was this a year in which coverage of war and the realities of war was transformed?
It was. You know, we will nitpick and we will discuss some of the coverage. Not all of it was great. Some of it was very myopic. Some of it was, you know, seeing the war through a straw, basically, as people say. But I think what's fascinating is that for the first time since Vietnam, we really did have Western journalists up close to the action in a way that I don't think anybody anticipated. And overall, I think it was a positive.
Yeah, but was it just to be difficult, Guy? At the same time, those embeds, did we see really the horror of war? I ask this in the context of something which may seem like it's coming from left field, but I was so struck a week or so ago when Diane Sawyer interviewed President Bush. And that interview, an important hour-long interview, lost in the ratings to heiress, some call her airhead, Paris Hilton romping around on a farm on her new reality TV show. Is it just being too grouchy to see a bit more of the death of civilization as we know it in that? And does everything end up, even embeds in the end, as entertainment?
Well, imagine the ratings she would have gotten if they'd shown her real videotape. No, I think that there is a lack of understanding, at least in this country, and I'm not sure whether the embeds had anything to do with it, about some of the mayhem that went on in Iraq during the period of the war. We're constantly reminded about 200 and I guess it's 8 Americans now that have died, but there are thousands of Iraqis that have been killed, and we didn't get to cover that from the position of the embeds. And somehow some of the other news media, particularly I've been watching BBC World, they were able to get some of that, and it gives you a more rounded perspective. I'm not saying change your mind on the war, but you might get a broader view of what it is that some people are concerned about.
Mark, you follow these things so closely. Does everything in the end, even an embed, have to be transformed to a degree into entertainment for Americans to swallow it? They'll watch Paris Hilton every time instead of the president being interviewed about Iraq and the economy and all that other stuff.
Well, presumably Paris Hilton's fame will be somewhat fleeting, but she will be replaced, I guarantee you, by somebody else in the continuum. You know, we're capable of focusing in on a war for 7 to 10 days at a time, and then we begin to look for relief in other aspects of the culture, and I think some of the other bigger stories this year have involved celebrity scandal to a degree that we haven't seen in recent years. The Lacey Peterson murder case seemed to be one of those that was just going to be just a tabloid feeding frenzy, and it got trumped by, obviously, the sexual assault charge against Kobe Bryant, which has subsequently been trumped by the charges against Michael Jackson. And the Michael Jackson case, whatever happens to it, threatens to become the next massive O.J. Simpson case, and barring literally truly major developments here or abroad, I think is going to be the water cooler talk in this country for the foreseeable future.
I want to ask you both, Guy, I'll start with you, Lacey, Kobe, Rush. And what about Arnold? Does Arnold, the new governor of California, of course, emerge from the same petri dish that his fame as an entertainer ended up managing to get him elected governor of California?
I tried to avoid the Arnold Schwarzenegger story as it was unfolding, and as an editor of a small newspaper in New Hampshire, I will tell you that I had trouble finding commentaries that weren't about Arnold Schwarzenegger for about 2.5 months. I don't think it was as an important a story as it was played in most of the United States media.
On one level, it is an important story for getting Arnold celebrity, and that is, essentially, there was a populist revolt here. You basically had the people in the largest state in the union tossing out a governor who had been elected a year earlier. That has serious implications for the entire political system. I think what Schwarzenegger did show here is that if you are a certain kind of celebrity candidate, which he was, you can run a race, a shortened race, let's remember that, by essentially doing an end run around traditional mainstream media scrutiny. He ran a gubernatorial candidacy that was essentially based on little more than beautifully staged photo ops of him shaking people's hands. He did a rope-a-dope with the press. They never laid a glove on him, and he got elected governor. That's not such a reassuring message.
I'm not sure it's unique, though. I remember in 2000 when George W. Bush came to Keene, New Hampshire, he didn't go to the radio stations, and he didn't go to the newspaper. He went to the Colony Mill Marketplace and shook hands. So, you know, there is a precedent for avoiding the tough questions.
Well, I wish we could ask you guys a couple more tough questions. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Guy McMillan, thank you very much. Guy's editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire.
You're welcome. Happy New Year.
And you too, Guy. And Mark Jerkowitz, media columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much, Mark.
My pleasure, Bill.
Still to come, how warm will our film reviewer feel about Cold Mountain? You're listening to Here and Now. Like sand through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives. The words, the music, are familiar to millions of Americans. The soap opera stalwart, Days of Our Lives, is approaching its 40th anniversary. And while it has enjoyed the loyal viewership vital for soap opera success, it's also had a loyal, long-time cast, which isn't such great news in an industry which loves the young and, well, the restless. The Days of Our Lives solution? A serial killer.
Oh. Oh, my God. It's you.
Here and Now's Robin Young spoke recently about the murderer's strategic targets with Gabriel Winkle, an editor at Soap Opera Weekly.
Well, where did this serial killer come from? Who ordered him or her?
Well, the head writer created him, James Riley, but the show was also given sort of an order from their parent company, Sony, that they had to trim down their budget, and that meant salaries. And what better way than to just, you know, create a whole murder mystery around them?
Right, and I'm sure it's made the show more dramatic than it normally is, but the actors can't be happy.
Well, we've heard that that when an actor is told there are various responses, some of them, you know, run crying from the executive producer's office, and others just say, well, you know, it was a good 30-year run. The interesting thing about this serial killer is that usually if a show has a serial killer, they'll knock off the postman, the babysitter. This serial killer is going after people who have been on the show for 30-plus years.
We heard that perhaps Detective Roman Brady.
Well, I cannot confirm or deny that.
I guess not. Hmm. Well, as most soaps are, this is a show that's known for its really bizarre twists. It's hazy, but one of the characters' bodies dropped from a piñata on Thanksgiving Day.
That's correct, and someone was smashed with a bottle. I will only give a little tease that someone gets married, and at the wedding reception, blood oozes out of the cake.
Oh, God. Are the ratings going up?
Yes. The ratings are really going up. And it's funny, the thing that's so funny is that we'll get letters. We hate it, we hate it, we hate it, but no one is turning it off.
Another thing that's interesting about this storyline is that it used to be, and especially on this show, characters hopping in and out of bed with each other and, you know, changing partners. And, you know, now it's carnage.
Right. Right. Well, there's still some hopping into bed with other people. But the soaps have, on the whole, become very careful about that kind of image, because in the age of safe sex, they really are trying to be a little bit more respectful of that, and that the young people, you know, don't get a bad message.
Right.
They get a bad message that there could be a serial killer in their town, but they're not encouraged
right.
to have indiscriminate sex.
Well, Gabrielle, thank you.
You're welcome.
Gabrielle Winkle, an editor for Soap Opera Weekly.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Cold Mountain, Charles Frazier's best-selling novel, is now a hugely expensive movie. It's about a Civil War veteran's long, violent journey home after he's deserted the Confederate Army, disgusted with the brutality on the battlefield. Throughout, the main character, Inman, dreams of returning to his sweetheart, Ada, who in his absence has been besieged by suitors, like Penelope in another odyssey about a war veteran returning home.
So much time has passed since you left, and no word from you. Are you alive? I pray to God you are.
Joining us in the studio is Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Bill.
The plot, as we said, is pretty much the Odyssey, right? Civil War time.
To a large extent. You have these two characters, Inman, who's a laborer in Cold Mountain, North Carolina, and Ada Monroe, the daughter of the local preacher. She's brought there by her father. And Inman and she sort of strike up this sort of distant relationship, but then they're separated by the war. And most of the film follows their parallel stories as he tries to get back to Cold Mountain and as Ada is forced to become self-reliant after her father's death.
I can talk about farming in Latin. I can read French. I know how to lace up a corset, God knows. I can name the principal rivers in Europe, but just don't ask me to name one stream in this county.
She waits for Inman, and he pines for her, even though they've barely shared half a dozen words before their separation.
Now, in the book, Eric, a lot of it's about some very powerful and lyrical writing, and a lot of it's interior monologues. How does that transfer to the screen?
Well, we get some of that through Ada's letters to Inman. So we get Nicole Kidman doing a certain degree of narration throughout the film.
Now, as for Nicole Kidman, big question, of course, how's her chemistry once they do get reunited with Jude Law, who plays Inman?
It's okay, but I have to say that one of the major flaws with this film is that both of the main characters, Ada and Inman, are fairly colorless. Where the film really takes off is in the supporting players, these secondary characters. You've got a lot of great character actors like Donald Sutherland, Kathy Baker, and James Gammon, who really add a lot of color to the film.
Uh-huh. And also Renee Zellweger, key player.
Exactly. And the film really does come to life when Renee Zellweger shows up about an hour into the movie. She really does steal the film as this little backwoods girl who teaches Ada how to tend farm, how to, you know, darn socks and the whole gamut.
Old Lady Swinger says you need help. Here I am. Number one, you got a horse? I can plow all day. I'm a worker. Number two, ain't no man better than me because there ain't no man around who ain't old, full of mischief.
Eric, this was a hugely popular, best-selling novel. How does that affect a movie, you think, when a lot of people know the outlines of the plot and have images in their minds already from having read the book?
Yeah, it is often hard for filmmakers to adapt a novel to the screen because they have to meet the expectations of people who have read the novel. At the same time, they also have to adapt to the conventions of filmmaking, which really require, you know, a certain degree of action, a certain degree of forward momentum. And I'm not entirely sure that Anthony Minghella has, you know, gotten this film entirely right. He really does gravitate towards this kind of material, these stories of tragic love, and he tends to sort of overblow them.
Huh. Well, he did The English Patient right. And The Talented Mr. Ripley for right. Miramax. There was an enormous attention to detail. Is it at least a beautiful film to look at?
Yeah, I mean, and that's where Minghella, I think, really does excel. He is a real visual stylist. He's able to capture mood of a place very well. And this film does have its very poetic moments. It also has its hellish moments. There's a battle scene early on in this movie where you see hand-to-hand combat, and it's really rough going.
A lot of movies out there this holiday season worth going out of your way for? I get the feeling that
I wouldn't go out of my way for it. I think, you know, if folks are, you know, read the novel, they might find it worthwhile. If you're into the period, that Civil War era, you might find it interesting. If not, you know, maybe rent it when it comes out on DVD.
Oh, there you go.
Sorry.
Aaron Now film critic Eric Schaefer. We've been reviewing Cold Mountain, which opened this week. Eric, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Bill.
Mr. President, I beg to present you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah. That was the beginning of a telegram that General William Sherman sent to President Abraham Lincoln in December 1864, near the close of the Civil War. Sherman had just cut a swath through Georgia, burning Atlanta and whatever else lay in his path on his march to the sea. The process of putting the country back together after the Civil War is the subject of a new American Experience documentary, Reconstruction, the Second Civil War, which is scheduled to air in January. We're joined on the line now by series producer Elizabeth Dean. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
General Sherman, though presenting Savannah as a gift, didn't burn that beautiful city down as he did others. Do we know why, just to get started?
Well, I think it was because it was a beautiful city, and it was maybe because it was Christmas. But he set up his headquarters right there in the middle of Savannah in a grand house in Madison Square. And I think, you know, if we actually stick with this situation at Christmas time, 1864, it tells you quite a lot about what Reconstruction is about. You know, it's pretty clear by this moment that the North is going to win the Civil War. The South was thought to have been unconquerable, but there it was.
Now, Sherman and his men are in Savannah celebrating on oysters and turtle soup. Mm-hmm. But all around the city, camped on the outskirts, are former slaves, freed people now, with nothing. Many are hungry, some are sick, but they're also, a lot of them, very hopeful that now they're going to have a chance at a new life.
Did better days come? Do Americans now realize the turmoil that came in the wake of the Civil War?
I don't think people understand what happened, that there was, in fact, a second war at the end of the Civil War.
Yeah.
But if you look at what had to be done, you know, if you sort of ripple out from that scene in Savannah and those campfires around the outskirts, you have a broken nation. You have enormous losses on both sides, 600,000 dead. And you have 4 million former slaves, people who've been ignored for centuries and who somehow have to be brought into the life of the country.
Did slaves see better days besides the fact that they'd won their freedom?
They saw better days briefly, I would say, and it accomplished remarkable things. Set up schools, set up communities, set up churches. But for many white Southerners, this was a world turned upside down, and there would be enormous resistance over those years and a lot of violence.
Did the Lincoln administration prepare sufficiently for Reconstruction, or were they primarily concentrated on winning a war?
They had to be concentrated on winning the war. But Lincoln could see and was trying to ease, you know, take those very early first steps towards reconciling the two halves of the country and towards bringing the former slaves into the life of the country. But he was assassinated.
Yeah. And Reconstruction was a long, hard slog. It's arguable that blacks didn't receive hardly any of the rights they were supposed to receive until 100 years later, really, in the 60s, the Civil Rights Movement. Is that
100
right?
100 years later, Bill. Some of these rights, it was a huge constitutional revolution, you know, the vote, equal protection under the laws, all these things were enacted for African Americans, and briefly in flower. But those rights were taken away after about 1877 when the last troops left. And those doors did not open again until the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s.
It was a Christmas 140 years ago when General William Sherman said to President Lincoln, "I present to you the city of Savannah." That was in some ways the beginning of Reconstruction. We've been talking to Elizabeth Dean about it. She's the series producer of Reconstruction, the Second Civil War, which airs on PBS stations around the country, January 12th and 13th. Elizabeth Dean, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join us next time for the news in these stories here and now. A year after it first emerged, we take a look at the global economic and medical toll SARS has taken. And our Washington Roundtable mixes politics with religion. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.